Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It's October 11th, 2021, and this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC, or you can email me anytime, Jason@overthecap.com. Pretty crazy week in football. You know, who would have thought it? So last week I recorded, I think, on a Tuesday night, or Tuesday afternoon, actually. And next thing you know, by the time we even got that one prepared to roll out, it was just like hit after hit after hit. In terms of traffic to the website, I mean, it was like a little mini free agency between the Dallas Cowboys' release of linebacker Jalen Smith, and that was followed then by the news that the Patriots were going to release Stephon Gilmore, and then subsequently he was traded to the Carolina Panthers. So I guess we'll start with those, and then we'll talk a little bit about the games from yesterday. I'm doing this before the Monday game, so I don't know what the results will be of that. I was going to talk a little bit about free agency, just the concept of it, and maybe I'll talk about that a little bit, depending on how long we go here. But I'll try to keep this under an hour today. For those that wondered about the Twitter Spaces session, I had an issue still getting the download on that. I thought I had that straightened out. But I still kind of had an issue with that. So I'll hopefully get that straightened out for the future. I didn't do one this past week. If I can figure out how to get those old ones, I'll still put them online, since they're mainly just Q&A kind of stuff. So I think they're just going to be as timely whenever they go on, you know, as they would be any other time. But hopefully I'll be able to do one this weekend. It depends on what the kids' schedules are for their football games and stuff. I was way behind on transactions this week. So Saturday, by the time we got home, I pretty much had to spend time catching up on transactions and doing a couple things for fantasy, and just didn't have enough time for that. Plus, there was the boxing as well. So I just didn't get enough time for that. Oh, and Nelly's here with me. Nelly, you got anything? Nelly's got nothing right now. So anyway, I guess the bigger of the two is probably the Gilmore news. And it was a out of left field kind of surprise, but I think this was one of those deals where Belichick and the Patriots just did not want to deal with someone who was just probably a complete malcontent with the contract. Gilmore, for quite some time, had been pressing about his contract. You know, it's a really interesting, I think when you go back and you look at it, it's a real interesting kind of contract history. Let me just pull up his history here to see. But he's one of the rare free agents who really, really, really worked out. Now, you can argue about, did he work out for the entire length of the contract? And the answer for that is no. But I would say he pretty much beat the system for working out on a contract here. So let's just pull him up. So he signed with New England as a unrestricted free agent in 2017. He came off a couple of seasons with the Buffalo Bills. And the Patriots signed him to a pretty lucrative deal. $13 million a season at that point in time was top 10 money, I would guess. It wasn't top of the market, but Gilmore, coming off that last season in Buffalo, I don't think was considered a top of the market player. I think that this money at the time actually was a little surprising to some people. Not completely surprising, not like some of the stuff that the Patriots did in free agency this year, but was clearly he was a player that they liked, a player they targeted, and a player that they made a very strong offer to where he probably would not turn that kind of contract down. The deal was front loaded, and that was probably what sealed the deal. It was $23 million in the first year. So the money up front, $18 million to sign, $23 million total in cash in that first year, up to $23 million, I should say. There was some per game roster bonuses in there. You know, really was, that was top market kind of money on the front end. And then it petered down if he ended up overplaying kind of the contract, which he did. And that's rare for a free agent to do, but that was what he did. When things started off with him, I was negative on that contract. I was negative with how things were going. I think a lot of people were. It took him a little bit of time, I think, to kind of get into the Patriots system. But then once it clicked, he was pretty much great for 3 years, two and a half, two and three quarter years, whatever you want to call it. You know, he was great, but things got messy after that, right? So he makes $9 million in the second year in the deal, $10 million in the third year of the deal. And that's the year where he's defensive player of the year. And he's going to go in the next season and he's going to play for 11 in the final season. He's going to play for 12. And that's way undervalued for where he was. So the contract issues really began last year. And what the Patriots did to kind of try to minimize the situation. The Patriots have kind of done this a little bit before with some players. They did this with Gronkowski, I believe. They did this with Brady. Little different bits and pieces. But what they did is they threw an extra $2 million in incentives that were very unlikely to be earned. You know, he had to be Defensive Player of the Year again, if I remember correctly. And the other thing they did was they took money from the final year of his contract and they moved it forward. So instead of $11 million, they bumped his salary by $4 million up to $15 million last year. And his salary in 2021 would drop by a corresponding $4 million. That was well and good to quote-unquote band-aid the contract, because that's all it was doing. Because when you got the salary this year to be $8 million, $7 million base, $500,000 per game, and then close to another $500,000 in a roster bonus if he was on the roster for 17 games, there's no way he's going to play for that. Because now you've gone from a situation that he didn't like playing on $11 million to now you're going to say, hey, buddy, play for $8 million. There's no chance on that. So I think he looked for an extension and that wasn't coming. I think he looked for a raise. That wasn't coming. And New England's salary cap situation this year is not good. So I think New England looked at this and said, okay, we've got this player on the physically unable to perform list. We need salary cap relief. Right now, the New England Patriots before this did not have the space on their roster to deal with their per game bonuses that were on the roster. That was my guess at that. Just a quick look. And then I think Miguel confirmed that. Confirmed that that was definitely the case there. I think he talked about that on his Spaces session as well, about how hard up they were. And New England has certain players that might qualify for injury protection who were released this past season. And there have been some discrepancies between the numbers we have, the number the league has, and the number that the Players Association reports. The league report leaks, obviously, are the most accurate of all. And that might be that those kind of pop through. Now, the way per game bonuses work is when those accrue during the year, they actually get added onto your cap. So you have to have cap room to deal with that. And they weren't going to, because they had a lot of players who didn't play last year, had limited amounts of playing time, and they had big per game bonuses on there. So they needed cap relief. It sounds as if they went to him, and I'm going to guess what they probably said was, hey, buddy, we need to add 4 void years onto your contract and, you know, bring the money down. And I think he rightfully said no. Like, you're either giving me a raise or I'm not doing it. Like, why would I help you out, help you manage your salary cap if I'm not getting anything out of it? You know, that's something that I talked about with the Fletcher Cox restructure and some other deals. You know, if a player is not going to get anything out of a restructure, they're unhappy to begin with their contract. Like, why should they help the team out? So New England's best recourse on this really was to just cut him, you know, or try to trade him, obviously. He's not going to be happy. He's going to come off the physically unable to perform list, in a couple of weeks. You're not going to be able to hide him on there and stash him on there and keep him away. He's probably going to be unhappy after every single game, at least when he first returns. He's going to get nothing but questions about his contract. You probably don't want that. You know, while New England's not great this year, they're passable, and it seems like some of the guys there are certainly, Judon in particular, seem to be having a pretty good time, I think, playing in New England. And it probably is just not worth that risk, you know, with bringing someone in who's going to be unhappy and you're going to put them on the field. Maybe that upsets the apple cart. They have they should have a good secondary on paper. They have good players. So maybe they look at this as expendable. Now, they announced they're going to release him, and I'm sure the reason they announced they're going to release him is you're hoping that you can find a trade partner. Probably what happened is the initial group of teams that they looked to peddle him to probably weren't interested. And it was going to be very hard to trade for him. People were bringing up names like, well, the Packers could use him and this and that. And, you know, I even made a post that if he's released and he wants to earn $10 million for the rest of the year, you can easily do that with void years and stuff. You can probably get him down to about a $2-4 million cap hit. Anybody can absorb that. If you trade for a player, you have to trade for their existing contract. So you needed to have the cap space to fit him in there. And that was going to be about $6.2 million. And there was only a handful of teams that could absorb $6.2 million on a trade. And one of those ended up being Carolina. I think this is a terrific trade for Carolina. Carolina's defense is terrific. This gives them a chance to you know, really jump out. It's only a 6th round pick. They might get more back for him in a compensatory level. Now, given the way the roster is constructed, I don't think they can be thinking compensatory, you know, as a true possibility, but there is a possibility that that at least exists. So, you know, you get a player for cheap as long as you can deal with his contract for this year, and then you see what's going to happen. Because Carolina's got, they have something on defense this year. Not surprisingly, their offense is turning back into a pumpkin with Darnold. You know, he's looking more and more like New York Jets version of Sam Darnold. I guess that's what happens when you don't play the Jets or teams like the Jets at the beginning of the season every week. They're going to have to win right now with their defense. And I think that things are kind of wide open. And I think this is a very good acquisition to say, hey, you know, things are going good for us right now. And maybe this makes it go even better. You know, I'm long a proponent. A lot of people are not. I've become more, much more in the last couple of years, a proponent of making these trades in season rather than off season. When you make a trade in the off season, you have no clue. All right. Yeah. If you have a special quarterback, there's a handful of teams where you can pencil yourself in and go, all right, we're barring injury. We're not going to be worse than like 7-8 wins on a year, 9 wins, you know, something like that. So basically you're not giving away a, you know, a top pick or something like that. Most of the time, if you're that kind of team, but when you're not that kind of team, you have no clue. You are just as likely to win 5 games as you are 12 games. And I know every team goes into it very bullish and they think, yeah, you know, this is great. But the reality is you have no clue as to how things are going to be. However, if you're in the middle of a season, I know this is kind of early, but when you're in the middle of a season, you do have an idea. You know, maybe this is just one of those years where the ball is going to bounce your way. And I kind of think that's what Carolina is. Carolina's model, I don't think is sustainable, like over a long term, over the long haul. But I think in the short term, they have a possibility of, you know, making a playoff run here. I'm not saying they're going to do great, but they have that possibility of doing it. It makes far more sense to see where you are after 4 or 5 games. Yeah, it would have been better if you could have waited a little bit longer, but it's better to see yourself after 4 or 5 games, make these moves that are going to benefit you now versus waiting until next year to say, okay, well, you know what we were missing last year? God, we needed a cornerback. So now we're going to go and we're going to pay $15 million a year for a player like Gilmore in free agency, or we're going to trade for someone like the Seahawks did Jamal Adams in the offseason 2 years ago. That doesn't benefit you because you might turn back into a pumpkin the next year. So I think more teams, when things are going good and you're getting the bounce of the ball and everything is going your way, I think more teams should be aggressive like this and make these trades, especially when really all you're doing is trading cap space. I mean, a 6th round pick is very, very limited as to what you're giving up. And I think this is a better way for teams to approach stuff. Now, I think this is one of the reasons why the trade deadline would be great if it was later in the season. I think you'd see a lot more movement. But yeah, this was, I think this was a good move for Carolina. And it's basically a salary cap dump by New England coupled with not wanting to deal with the headache of, I think a player who probably didn't want to be there anymore on this contract. You know, like I've talked about many times with deals, sometimes players will be willing to go somewhere else and play for the same or less money than they will with an existing team where they feel insulted by the team they've played for all these years, not looking to step up and give them a raise or make a longer term commitment. You know, if they go into free agency or you get traded someone, you go, okay, well, it is what it is. But when it's that original team, sometimes you get pretty upset about it. Some people were asking about why the salary when he was going to get cut wasn't guaranteed. It's because he wasn't on the roster in week 1. In order to get that termination pay protection, you have to be on the roster, the active roster week 1. He was not. He's on a reserve list. So that did not protect his salary for the season. And the second thing with that is, had he been activated before they traded him, the Patriots definitely would have been on the hook for at least 35% of the remaining salary that was there. So that's a reason why they probably wanted to move him before the pup list kind of stuff expired and he had to move back to practice because they would have had to guarantee a portion of the deal. So it would have been a little bit harder to move on from him then. So I think they just wanted to get it out of the way right now. Just get it finished, just get it done with. So interesting move. Definitely caught a lot of people off guard, definitely caught a lot of people by surprise. And, you know, it is what it is. Then you move into Dallas, and Dallas with Jalen Smith. I mean, I was shocked by this one as well. And I can't figure out the logic in that one at all. Like, I can figure out this one with the Patriots. I can't figure out the one with the Cowboys. There were so many different moving parts here. I just don't understand why this really wasn't done in the offseason. Now, I did get one thing completely wrong on this when I first posted about this. I said that they could have released him in March and basically gotten out of the guarantee this year. And that was not the case. He had a wrist injury. I didn't realize he had a wrist injury, but I guess he got a wrist injury late in the season. And I guess Dallas must have authorized surgery, you know, for it. Or I guess they had to, he had to get surgery on it, whatever it was. And that allowed his guarantee to kick in. Now, the spin on this when they released him was that they were petrified of his guarantee next year kicking in. Because next year he had $9.2 million guaranteed for injury, and they were afraid that the same thing could happen. If you're that afraid of that, if you're fearful of that happening, why in the world were you playing him the first 4 weeks of the season? Why in the world was he on your team at all during the summer? If you were stuck with that 7-2, you've got an offset on the salary, release him. Say, all right, we're stuck. Release him. You know, or you come with the other option, which is you tell him in the summer, hey, listen, you know, we're not going to play you unless you negotiate this injury protection out. Now, maybe they did try and do that. I don't know if they did or did not, but that's the typical route that you would go. So if you're worried about this injury kicking in, the things that you do, A, you don't play the player. You know, you do the kind of silly stuff we would see where guys run scout teams and stuff like that. You know, because of the contract, and eventually you go to the player and you get them to try to move on from that guarantee. Yeah, the player can collect money and not play, and you know, that's great, you know, whatever. Everybody that plays in the NFL is competitive. Everybody that plays in there wants to get on the field. All right. Yeah, there comes a point, there are points where that contract stuff becomes a sticking point. More often than not, it's in the offseason. So I don't know why they just didn't try to get that out from there. But if he's not going to take it out, you're starting him in weeks two and weeks three. How does that make any sense? And then you're so worried about it. He still played 55% of the snaps or so before he got cut. He was playing on special teams. What are you doing? Like, is this one of those things where one group of people is thinking one way and another group of people is thinking something completely different? Like, everybody has to be on the same page with that. Just absolutely terrible as a contract. Absolutely awful. You know, I defended this deal a little bit. I thought it was creative the way that Dallas kind of did this stuff, but you know, they ended up paying him basically $20 million for four games. You know, if his play was that contingent, if his role was that contingent on Garrett being the head coach and Garrett's staff being on the team, you don't extend a player like that when you have a coach that's on the hot seat. You know, Garrett was on the hot seat when he walked into that season. You knew if you didn't make the playoffs, he was going to go. Right? What did Dallas finish that year? Dallas finished 8-8. You knew he was going to go without making the playoffs. And it's like, why did you do that? He was under contract for the next 2 years. You know, he's going to make $1.3 million in 2019. And you were going to be able to put the RFA tender. They valued him as a one. So it would have been about $4.7 million. And they would have been a free agent. Instead, they paid him close to six. Then they played him close to 13. And now they paid him 7-2 for these couple of games. It's like the logic on that makes no sense at all. And you shoot yourselves in the foot with the guarantee, with the offset on this. Now, I don't know if he's going to claim it or not. This is kind of an interesting one. But basically, the way this works is with an in-season release, Jalen Smith has double protection. So he has protection from his guaranteed salary from Dallas. And if he signs with someone else, like he did, he signed with Green Bay the day after he was released for the bare minimum, $770,000. That number is offset by Dallas. That number offsets Dallas's obligation to him by $770,000. The Thing is, though, he still has protection under termination pay. So termination pay, they only subtract out the guaranteed salary that's paid by the team. So that offset is pulled out from that. So Dallas on the hook for 7-2 no matter what. So now I'm not saying that that would have been a big savings, but they could have saved themselves $1 million by getting rid of him in August. And they would have saved themselves the headache of him possibly getting injured and bringing in this $9.2 million salary guarantee. This is just a position you don't want to pay. It really is. Dallas, I think decision wise, has made a couple of tough ones between that and the Ezekiel Elliott. It's like you can do one or the other. You can't do both. I know Dallas doesn't get into doing free agency and all that kind of stuff, but you can do one. You can't do both. And they opted to do both here. And I think that put them, especially when they look at where their cap was next year, I think that probably put them in a bad spot with everything. So, I mean, they were prior to that move. Let me see where they were. They were probably right up against the cap next year. They were way over. They're $20 million over next year, even after that move was processed. You know, now they're going to free up space with, redoing Dak's deal and all that stuff. That's, you know, that's all built in. So the 22 over is not really, or 20 over is not really 20 over. But, you know, they would have saved themselves at least $1 million on that. And it saves you the headache of just looking, I don't know, ridiculous kind of doing this the way it was done. I'm surprised they couldn't trade him. You know, even if you have to eat $6.2 million of the salary and you get someone to pay him $1 million, eat 6-2. It's better than eating 7-2. You know, if he has to lose that guarantee, well, he'll probably agree to lose it to go to another team if he's going to get a role playing, I would think. You know, there's more value in having a multi-year deal versus a one-year deal because you do get certain inherent injury protection through the collective bargaining agreement. You know, so he'd have probably $2 million in inherent injury protection anyway. So I don't know. The whole thing just seemed like a mess from the start. And one of those things where clearly the organization was not on the same page. And I don't know what triggered it the way that it happened, but something doesn't seem right with it. And I don't know. You know, who knows? Maybe this was a player they did have a trade market for, and then the trade market fell. You know, maybe something occurred with another organization, and they pulled out of the mix for whatever reason, and then that left Dallas with an issue. I don't know. But yeah, this was a pretty bad one, in my mind. So the other stuff that happened this week that's also really bad is if you are a Seattle Seahawks fan, you have got to be petrified right now because you made this awful trade for Jamal Adams. And we said at the time it was a risky trade. It was a bad trade. It was a trade that if there was a payoff to that trade, that payoff to the trade was in 2020. You had a little bit more understanding of what your team was, where everything was there with that group of players. You had the quarterback and everything else. And you were not going to get any benefit from draft picks or other players last season based on the time that they made that trade. If you don't make a giant leap forward, you know, championship game of the playoffs, Super Bowl appearance kind of stuff. Well, now you're losing something by not having those draft picks because those draft picks could have contributed and you would have probably had an opportunity via trade or free agency to have found another safety without having to give up multiple number one picks to bring him in. And this is disaster scenario, as I said, for Seattle because they lost their quarterback. And that team is really heavily dependent on him at this point in their, I don't know, cycle right now. Jamal Adams is not a difference maker. Jamal Adams is a jack of all trades player that has an incredibly high draft pedigree. He does some unique things for a safety, but he doesn't really do traditional things for a safety. You have a $17 million a year player on a pretty bad defense, and you don't have a quarterback. Your quarterback is now Geno Smith. Wilson's going to miss, it sounds like, a couple of weeks here. And if that's enough to really drop you down to where you could end up with like a top 12, 13 pick that's going to go to the Jets now because of this trade. So it's like, what can you do now? It's like some people are like, well, let's start to, maybe now they start to rebuild. You don't bring back certain players on the defense. You start to make changes and, you know, you see where things go. Well, you don't have a high draft pick. Now, might you trade Russell Wilson? You know, he was upset last year with the contract, you know, or at least with being in Seattle. I don't know if it was with the contract. He's got two more years, I think, under his deal with Seattle. He's how old? 31? He was 31 when he signed his last deal. That's what I'm thinking of. So he's 33. So now you're going to have to start to question certain things, I would guess, with that future. And it's like, if he doesn't want to be here and then you run into an issue with him next year, what do you have? You know, Jamal Adams? This is just a really, really, really bad scenario now for Seattle because you have a player who's simply not making a difference and you might lose a really high quality pick. You know, it's one thing when you project yourself to be a playoff team and you go, well, you know, it's going to be a pick in the 20s. I get that. You know, I can understand that a little bit. But when you have that second blind pick in there, again, you're just running a big risk. Now, it's less of a risk when you have the star quarterback, but if that star quarterback does happen to get hurt, well, then what happens? Now, there's a lot of people that are probably going, oh, they could have had a better backup. That doesn't really work in the NFL. All right. Yeah, maybe it gives you a little bit of peace of mind. It doesn't really work in the NFL. I mean, you're not replacing Russell Wilson with a backup quarterback. You're just not. He's too good of a player, too unique of a player. You know, you're just not. And that's one of the reasons why I think that, their approach, which is to basically go bare minimum as your backup, I think is probably a fair one because I'd rather pay Geno Smith $1 million than getting someone else, getting Chase Daniel for 3 or 4. You know, I think that just makes more sense. Or getting Nick Foles for 6 or Andy Dalton for 10 or Ryan Fitzpatrick for, you know, any of those players. I think you're better off going the route they go where it's, you know, if Wilson gets hurt, we're screwed anyway. So why are we going to spend a ton on that position for a backup when it's probably not going to amount to much anything? Now, maybe they're better off having used a draft pick there to where you at least have someone with a higher ceiling than Geno, but we'll see. Maybe Smith will do okay for them. But the Jets are in a great position right now with their draft next year because of this injury to Wilson. And I think you have to be very, very concerned if you're Seattle with what you're going to look like for the rest of this year and what's going to happen next year. Other big story is out of nowhere, Jets rusher John Franklin Myers signs a $55 million contract extension with the Jets. It's a fair deal for both sides. I think the Jets came out better. They came out on the better end of this. I think he had potential to earn more than this in free agency. Now, you look at all these things. You still had weeks to go. He could fall off as a player. He could get hurt. You know, so I don't ever say that, you know, you should never ever consider taking it. This to me looked like a deal that just kind of came out of nowhere. And the Jets threw a deal in there where some of the things are very friendly to them. So the deal itself in terms of cash basically mimics the Josh Sweat deal in Philadelphia. And I think there's a lot of viable comparisons between the two players. So it seemed to me as if once the Eagles made that deal, that it became easier for the Jets, especially since he was having a pretty good season right now, for the Jets to very quickly swoop in and say, hey, we'll give you something very similar. And it's a 3-year deal in Philadelphia, 4-year deal here. And the 3-year numbers basically match up almost identical. I think he earns an extra $100,000 in the first 2 years. And I think it's even after year 3. Sweat goes to free agency in year 4. He gets a much bigger salary in year 4, which is why his annual value is higher than the Philadelphia players' annual value, but the contract is based on that. The guarantee structure in this is really funky. I haven't seen too many like this, and I have no idea why he agreed to this at all. So there are $30 million in guarantees in this deal, but it's not really $30 million guaranteed. The Jets guaranteed in this, and I'd have to look to see how much exactly it is, but basically, what they did is they guaranteed per game roster bonuses and weight bonuses as part of his guarantee. I think it's 1.2 million in those kind of bonuses that are guaranteed. I think that's the number, which is very high. So those guarantees only kick in if the player is actually released. It's not like guaranteed salary if he's on the team. So if he's on the team and let's say he gets hurt or whatever and he misses games, even though those per game bonuses are guaranteed, they're not really guaranteed. Unless they're of the 90 man variety, I don't know, maybe they are, but typically, you know, they're 48 man, you know, you're not going to earn them. So even though they're guaranteed, you're not going to earn them. So now, so maybe I'm speaking out a little bit because I don't know that full detail. So I could be wrong on that. The weight bonuses, absolutely, you have to make weight. So if he doesn't make weight, well, he's not going to get those bonuses. So, you know, it's a guarantee that's not really that kind of guarantee. So unless those are 90 man per game bonuses, that's a really good job by the Jets, I think, to get that deal done. I think to get that fourth year on the contract was really good by the Jets. So I think this was pretty solid by them. I don't know how you don't pull for this kid. I mean, he's cut from the Rams. No player, you know, that's been cut, especially that early in a rookie deal, you know, has had this kind of contract come his way. You know, just everything that you read about him, everything that you see about him is just, that's the stuff that you love with football. The guy basically is all pumped up about his contract, so happy about it, breaks down in tears talking about it, what it means for him and his family. I mean, that's everything that you want to see, I think, in a player. And, you know, you can argue again, should he have taken the deal? Should he not have taken the deal? You know, in the grand scheme of things, probably doesn't make that much of a difference, you know, to his life. So, you know, it's a very nice deal overall, but I think it definitely skews more towards the Jets side when you start to get into the nitty gritty of exactly what they did. Especially because you would think when one guy signs, and you already, I think, have a better track record than that player, you would expect to earn more on the front end, not 100,000 more. You'd expect to earn a lot more. And the Jets didn't. Jets don't put out really any cash this year. I think it's an extra $2 million. And so that trails pretty significantly. So that extra $100,000, if you look at like a time value kind of equation, really isn't even there. You know, in that respect, it's probably less than the Eagles deal. So I think it's a good one for the Jets. Now, I have a feeling, I would say that Marcus May probably looks at this and is pretty upset, probably hoping he gets traded. I know stuff came out now about a DUI that he had in February. Maybe that had something to do with the Jets' decision not to extend him. I don't know. But I would say you probably have to look at this and be pretty PO'd about it if you were him, because you didn't get that kind of offer that showed that you were like a cornerstone player with the team, you know, and they clearly didn't want to step up for you. And now you're sitting there injured and, from the sounds of it, just hoping you get traded. So I think that would be, that might be something just to be interesting to be a fly on the wall to see what he thinks about it. Just in terms of the Jets, opting to do that. So, that was the one Jets positive news. On the negative news, the Jets stunk this week, in London. They went and embarrassed the country with their level of play. No, it was bad. I didn't expect it to be as bad as it was. I'm not of the Jets turn the corner with that one win, but it was, I expected it to be better, but it was right back to kind of the way that things went the first couple of games, where the offense just has no rhythm, no anything for a first 25 minutes of a game. I mean, it's like that every week. They got hot last week with a bunch of big plays against a really bad Titans secondary. This week, they couldn't get hot. And Atlanta was doing everything to give the Jets an opportunity to come back in the game, and the Jets just couldn't do it. There are people that are upset with the coach. I don't see how you can be upset with the coach. You're a couple games in. The defense is much, much better than last year. They're not an incredibly talented group on paper. They've played with much more energy than they did for Adam Gase. They play a lot better. They play much better as a group. They run out of gas. That they collapse in the fourth quarter of these games, I think in part because the offense does nothing and they just run out of gas and they can't make a stop at the end. So that is one of those things that stops you from being a good defense. But it's certainly an improvement over where things were. And I think if you get better talent in there, you're going to see gigantic improvement, but you're still seeing energy. And I think that's a positive. So I don't know how you could be that down on him just from these couple of weeks because of how the quarterback has played. And the other one is people have started to get down on Zach Wilson already. You know, Zach Wilson right now is probably had the worst start of a Jets rookie that I can recall, you know, over a handful of games. I don't remember if McElroy started as a rookie. It was just one game. It was an atrocious game. I think it was against the Chargers. He got sacked like 8 million times. And I don't remember if he was a rookie that year or not. But that was the only game I think he started. But this start has been worse than Sanchez. It's been worse than Geno. Certainly worse than Pennington didn't play as a rookie. You know, it's worse than Darnold. It's bad. You know, and he is right now a much bigger work in progress than I thought he would be. I think you can be concerned. I think the excuse of things will be fine, Peyton Manning looked bad as a rookie, you completely take context out of it when you start doing those things. Now, is Wilson as bad as Sanchez? That's hard to say. You know, the Jets with Sanchez had a competitive team. So with a competitive team, sometimes you get a coach that just starts to put things in that doesn't allow the quarterback to really hang themselves. And that was what happened with Rex Ryan and Mark Sanchez, where they put handcuffs on Mark that were crazy, but you had to do it because the Jets had a defense that year that was just fantastic. And they didn't want him to completely squander a playoff opportunity. So they put a lot of checks in there against him that maybe would have kept him from being as bad as someone like Wilson, who doesn't really have that restraint right now. They're doing some restraining with a lot of the, you know, some of the early down stuff, but you fall behind, kind of let it fly, and you know, things go south. Right now, Wilson, the polish is not there whatsoever. Like there's no polish to the game at all. His game right now is to escape a pressure and to roll out, get out of the pocket and wing it. When he can do that and he's playing what essentially is like playground football, he's been effective. You see some big throws, you see him directing people, you see him moving people, and you know, he's got an arm that, you know, is, you know, he's got some arm talent that's there. When you put him in the pocket, he's a mess. He has no feel whatsoever for anything. I think you can see it with the way that he handles some of the pressures. You can see with the decision making, with where he throws the ball. There's no touch whatsoever to the way he passes. You know, Cutler had some issues with that years ago, but not to this level. Cutler would put them on guys; they'd just be thrown 120 miles an hour. This is just like a complete loss right now. You know, it's a little bit tough, I think, to watch. They need him to have more games like last week, but it 2 weeks ago. It's a work in progress. It's going to take a long time here. This is not, you know, this might be, you know, maybe like a Josh Allen type. Maybe, you know, Allen was always considered a work in progress as well. But this, I don't think this was the expectation when they drafted him. I think he was, well, I'm not considered the most pro ready of all the players. I think he was considered more pro ready than this. And that hasn't been the case. Now, pretty much all the rookies have stunk. You know, Jones has looked the most competent. I think people kind of expected that in a first year. Fields has made some really big plays. And then he had that one game that was terrible. Not enough to watch really of Lance yet. You know, and Lawrence, the little bits and pieces I've seen, I haven't seen a lot of them. But the little bits and pieces that I've seen, I think what you see with him is you see what would be considered traditional rookie mistakes with a really what's turned out to just be a terrible coaching staff and just a complete disaster over there. But I think what you're starting to see there is that he does have that polish at times. Like there are passes that he throws that are touch passes that are higher quality, I think, NFL passes, NFL throws. And you mix that in with bad decisions and bad throws as well. But I think you can look at that and probably be a little bit more hopeful, maybe along the Peyton Manning 98 lines. And remember, that was a very different league then too, versus what we see right now, out of Wilson. Now, doesn't mean Wilson's done, doesn't mean you don't bail on him. I think the thing you have to look at, and just look no further than Miami, when you go into these deep rebuilds, you need a quarterback. It doesn't work when you don't get the right quarterback. Miami made the cardinal sin, all right? They drafted a quarterback, perfectly fine. They didn't, when they had an opportunity, they didn't take a chance to insure themselves with another quarterback. All eggs in one basket, and Tua's hurt right away. They look terrible as a team. They have first round picks next year, but they gave away what looks like it's going to be a very high draft pick. You have to be willing to think out of the box if you want to break this curse. And most of these teams that go into these big rebuilds do not break the curse, because the true elite quarterbacks are few and far between. And unless you get lucky and you find one, you got to keep searching. All right. The Chargers look like they have one. The Bills got one. Surprisingly, most people thought that wasn't going to be the case. Arizona got one because Arizona broke the mold and they said, well, we're going to take quarterback again. Now, I would have played that different. I thought the right play was to keep Rosen on the team, but I guess they knew he was that bad. They just moved on. That's the right way to play it. And I'm going to say it right now. If there is a quarterback next year who's available, you know, unless Wilson has a major, major, major turnaround, and you've got all this draft capital, there is no reason, you know, to just be afraid of drafting a quarterback, to say, well, you know, Wilson's the guy. There's nothing wrong with having competition, and there's nothing wrong with using a draft pick on that position. There's just not. And if you want to say, well, that's kind of a wasted pick because we could get an edge rusher and he's going to play this year. You know, we can get a corner, he's going to play this year. Well, first of all, if the quarterback has to come in, even if Wilson turns out great and the other quarterback has to come in to relieve an injury, it's much more valuable than having a corner that's going to play 16 games if you have a guy that comes in for three. But even still, at the worst, most of the time, all it is a pick deferral, because you can usually peddle those picks for a first round pick again, unless the guy looks awful. And, you know, look at Rosen. Rosen got a two. You ever seen a quarterback worse than that? So at worst, I look at it as a pick deferral. But I think if the Jets are going to have any hope of success, you have to think outside of the box. Don't just throw yourself in and say, well, this is the guy. Yeah, you had to do that 12, 13, 14 years ago. When you drafted Sanchez, you had to do that because the money was so large, you could not afford to put two rookies on a team. If you put two rookies on a team, your investment in two rookie quarterbacks was going to be more than like a Peyton Manning player on a veteran deal, because that's how big the rookie contracts were. Now they're tiny. So what difference does it make? You're going to allocate $16 million to the position? Okay. Prescott makes 40. Allen makes 43. Mahomes makes 45. Do it. So I think the Jets should be at least considering that. And again, that has nothing to do with giving up on Wilson or not giving up on Wilson. It has nothing to do with that. It's just about having the most avenues to succeed, and teams block themselves from it. Years ago, I did a quick study on teams that go into this complete rebuild where you just gut your roster. All right. And the Jets have done that. The Bills did it. Dolphins did it. The Raiders did it. The Colts did it. The only teams that had little amounts of success with it were the teams that had quarterbacks. You know, Josh Allen became a player. Andrew Luck became a player. Derek Carr, not as much. You know, he had a good season. They made the playoffs once, and that's pretty much been it. You know, they haven't had any sustained period of success. The Saints didn't really go into a rebuild. That was a very different situation. They just had a ton of dead money from bad contract decisions, but they had Drew Brees. So eventually they bounced back from that once they were able to kind of hit in the draft and add to that roster to go around Drew Brees, who in his prime was obviously a terrific quarterback. But you look at teams like the Jaguars, you know, they've stunk. And if Trevor Lawrence doesn't hit, and they don't take an insurance policy at that position, if their insurance policy is, you know, 2 years from now, you're like, well, we're bringing in Jacoby Brissett. That'll show him like we mean business if he doesn't improve. It's like, what good is that? It's not insurance. You know, that's not lighting a fire under somebody. It's like you brought in Jacoby Brissett. You know, okay. you know, if you do look back, the teams that were not able to use whatever draft capital that they got to bring in a quarterback, because you can't get a quarterback in free agency. It has to be in the draft. You know, the teams that have been unable to fill through the draft, not because they haven't picked one, just because their picks have sucked and they've, you know, just try over and over and over again. You go for year one, then it's year two, then it's year three. And then you just like, all right, well, what are we going to do in year four? You just wasted a lot of time. You probably get fired. You know, it's probably gonna be somebody else getting that opportunity now. So you got to be proactive with it and just plan ahead. Now, that doesn't mean there's a quarterback this year that you take. I don't know anything about the players this year, but I think that has to be in the back of the Jets' mind right now, as well as everybody else who drafted a quarterback, you know, that actually still has draft picks. You know, some of the teams have given them all away. You know, if you had to move up, you know, you had to give them away. So, you know, I think that's it's just going to be an interesting discussion, I think, and it might not lead to anything, but I think it'd be an interesting discussion. All right. So anyway, the games this week, just trying to see what stood out. You know, I mentioned about the Jets there, Carolina, you know, you had Sam Darnold looking back like whatever. Texans, you know, that coach has done a pretty good job there. They lose the game, but they've done a pretty good job. Packers Bengals was like a comedy. I've never, the playing for field goals there was just crazy. You know, the guys couldn't hit anything. Pittsburgh Denver, that's a bad loss for Denver. I thought they would have won that game. Minnesota Detroit, interesting game, just because of the decision at the end. So there's about 40 seconds left in the game and Detroit decides to go for two. So Detroit gets a miracle that Minnesota turns the ball over deep in their own territory. Detroit scores a touchdown and they decide to go for two, and going for two puts them up one. And a lot of people were negative on that decision. I'm not negative on that decision whatsoever. If you just look at the pure win probability, yeah, taking a two is probably not the right move, because if you don't get the two, well, you don't win. And even if you get the two, it's not a guarantee that you win. But you know, you've put your chances, I would guess, up a point. I mean, I can run them, but I would guess you're probably anywhere from 65 to 75% chance of winning. You know, I know we always look at these games where these superstar quarterbacks drive down the field very easily and get a field goal. And that happened here. Not exactly a superstar quarterback, but I think you have to look at this. If you are coaching Detroit, all right, your team has done nothing offensively. You have zero offense. Your upside as an offense the entire game is basically being able to put together a 30-yard drive and kick a field goal. That's your upside. So if you go into overtime, I can't in a million years say, all right, we're going to go into overtime. We're going to drive the field and score a touchdown and win. I can't see that being a possibility. So you're going to have to hope, I guess, that you get the ball first and are able to drive down the field and get a field goal and then stop Minnesota from getting a field goal to at least tie the game. You know, and then you get the ball back and maybe you have time left to kick another field goal to win. You're going to have to get a second possession in overtime. So I just don't see overtime being a legit 50-50 chance for them, because they suck. And it's not like they were playing well. You can say that Minnesota was playing poorly, but if they convert that too, they have a much better chance of winning that game than if they go to overtime. Going to overtime, I don't think that the way they were playing, they have any chance of winning. Now, maybe they have a chance of tying, but I don't think they have any opportunity to win. And all they had to do was convert 2 yards, and it gives them a good chance to win. They don't stop them, leads to a long field goal. They make the field goal. It is what it is. There's no reason to think with two timeouts. And I know the Minnesota is so conservative, but if you have two timeouts and there's 40 seconds on the clock, Minnesota should still be going for that field goal. So your chance of losing, whether you're tied or you're up one, should be the same. I know some teams do get more conservative, and Minnesota is probably the most conservative of them all. And maybe after that turnover, maybe they would be ultra conservative. Maybe they would do that silliness of just doing like a screen pass on the first play of that drive. And if it doesn't go for 15 yards, you just say, all right, we'll pack it in. We'll beat them in overtime. But if you're sitting there two timeouts and you know a field goal wins the game, you should still be aggressive. So whether you are tied or you're up one, the level of aggression from Minnesota should be identical. You know, their willingness to try to push the ball to get a field goal should be identical, unless they're that petrified of their quarterback. Maybe they are. Maybe it would have been the case. But I think it's the right call for Detroit to do that, because I think if you look at Detroit, you look at the roster, and you look at the way they were playing that day, really the way they've played all year, but certainly the way they were playing that day, overtime was not a path for them to win. It was probably going to require them to get two possessions and be perfect on two possessions, perfect for them, to get two field goals. I could believe they could hold Minnesota out of the end zone. But if Minnesota gets the first possession, you're going to tie, and then it's going to be Minnesota that has that chance to go for the win for three, not you. So I think just way too many things would have had to happen in Detroit's favor to somehow win that game. So I think that was absolutely the right call, even though it's a crushing defeat. And even that's one of those situations where the numbers will tell you one thing. But I think if you look at the quote unquote numbers for Detroit in particular and how that game was being played, I just don't think, unless you're just happy with a tie, I just can't see why you wouldn't take that shot and say, all right, 2 yards, and then we hold them for 40 seconds, versus the other option of just going into overtime. I just don't see it. Raiders, you know, I said last week I didn't think the Raiders were very good. They're starting to look like they're not very good. Arizona, San Francisco, Dallas all over the Giants. Giants are just – everybody gets injured. Barkley gets hurt. People were going up in arms about his ankle, like how bad it looked. If you've ever played any little bits of basketball, you've had ankles that have done that and a lot worse. So I would say, looking at that, I don't think I would have been too worried about it whatsoever, even though that swelling looks obviously terrible. But when you look at the way he got hurt on that play, and it was freakish, what a weird game for Tony. You know, it was certainly a freakish way for him to get hurt. I don't think he'd be too worried about that. If you've done sports where you can roll your ankles a lot, the swelling happens really quick and it's nasty looking. And a lot of times, especially when you're younger, and I'm sure when you're an athlete like that, it goes away pretty quick, you know. And it was a strange game for Tony, man. That kid had a coming out party, but talk about strange stuff. I mean, he busts up Barkley's ankle. I think that was him that did that. He headbutts Jabril Peppers on the sideline and just outburst and, you know, just made a mistake. You know, it wasn't doing it intentional, just upset with whatever. And Peppers happened to kind of be there. Goes off for a billion yards. And the next thing you know, he's throwing a punch at the end of the game. His coach is all angry at him. He gets thrown out of the game. I think if he wasn't thrown out, the coach was throwing him out anyway. Just a strange game. Strange game for him there. And then you had the two games that I think are the really cool ones to talk about. So you had Buffalo, Kansas City. You know, Buffalo, I think people were waiting to see if there was there was a litmus test, I think, for Buffalo. And I don't think people wanted to believe some of the stuff about the team, how their defense had played and how they were offensively. They manhandled Kansas City. Kansas City has not looked good this year. Kansas City is too reliant right now on certain types of plays, and the Bills took those big plays away. You eliminate players like Hill from just running all over the field. You really take a lot away from that offense. And they basically copied what Baltimore did a couple of weeks ago. And, they really held that offense in check for a big portion of the game. And Kansas City's defense looks like it's historically bad. And these teams are just attacking, and they can't cover. They can't generate a pass rush. So Allen sits back there for like 6 seconds of play, and you have guys just wide open down the field. I don't care who it was. They were wide open down the field. I mean, Dawson Knox had a gigantic catch for a touchdown. Just huge. Just getting behind everybody. It's just really bad. I mean, Diggs should have had a touchdown. He just turned around and was ready to dance in the end zone, not realizing that, at least they were giving effort to try to chase him down. But the Bills look by far to be the best team in the AFC, just tremendous. You're not going to say Kansas City is done, You know, that's not the case. They have too much talent for that, and they'll beat up on a lot of teams. But I don't think this is a gimme that, you know, Kansas City, you just say, okay, you know, they're going to be perfectly fine. You know, basically what's going to happen is their offense will beat up on teams. Like, I'm just pulling up their schedule. I mean, their next two games are against Washington, Tennessee, and then the Giants after that. I mean, they're just going to pummel those teams, especially Washington and Tennessee. I mean, they'll just pummel those defenses, which are awful, awful, awful defenses. So, you know, they'll pummel them. And I think from there, the question is, can Kansas City's defense, when you get into the December, January timeframe, can they get some stuff sorted out, get hot, and just be somewhat competent when you get to the playoffs? Defenses can do that. But right now, they have a defense that is just historically bad at this point, and, you know, is really going to get ripped up by these teams that just have a lot more offensive talent and are willing to just really push the game. But that was a big win for Buffalo. And they went in there, and they just took that game over right away and never really looked back. And then the coolest game of the week by far was Chargers Browns. I mean, this was really something. So, you know, first of all, both teams played incredibly well, but the stuff that was really interesting, you know, was a lot of the decision making that went on. You know, a lot of times we talk about like chess games in the NFL and stuff. Like, I remember, you know, speaking as a Jets fan, when Mangini came and was the coach of the Jets, and he was coaching against Bill Belichick. Talk about the master chess matches between the two. You know, do this, and the counter is this, and this, and this. This was totally different than that. You know, it was very different. And, you know, my buddy Eric Eager mentioned on Twitter, you know, he thought this game was better than the Bills-Rams shootout the Chiefs-Rams shootout from a couple of years ago. I think it was 51-45, that game. And, you know, I think this game was better too, but I think those games are very different. You know, the Chiefs and the Rams game was all about talent. You know, it was about that traditional, like, okay, McVay doing some innovative stuff on offense, you know, to just keep pushing. And it was about the Chiefs just having players who were ridiculously dominant. You know, you couldn't cover them. You know, you couldn't cover Tyreek Hill. He had like 200 yards in that game. You know, that was more reminiscent of, you know, when I was a little kid and Dan Marino and Ken O'Brien would have these games where every play seemed like it was a touchdown. You know, that's what the games were. That's what that game was like. It was, just bombs away, you know, move. This was all kinds of strategy. This was the Chargers doing a bunch of stuff like on fourth down early on. Basically, I think they looked at this and they said, okay, you know, this game is going to get out of hand for us. You know, they were down. What were they down? 27-13? Let me just pull up. Yeah, 27-13. And at that point, you know, they realized they need to score and they need to get ahead and they need to completely change the game, because if they don't do it, you know, they're just going to fall out from it. Like, you can't go down 27-13 punt on fourth down and say, well, we'll get them next time, because the way that game was going, you were probably going to be down 34-13 in the blink of an eye. You know, and even if you weren't, even if you stopped them, at some point you were going to run out of time. You weren't going to have time to make up that deficit. So they were doing some cool stuff. They were doing the 2-point conversion things. And they were consistent with everything until the end, where I thought they should have gone for the two at the end of the game, and instead they went for the tie, and obviously the guy misses the extra point. I think they would have been better off actually being up in that spot, but, you know, that's neither here nor there. Chargers get the ball. Cleveland, I don't know why Cleveland on that last drive, almost like a 3rd and 10, I think, run. I mean, the Mayfield is a limiting factor there. You know, Mayfield is, I don't know, he's just not great. I mean, I'm just looking at this last drive. So last drive that they have, Kareem Hunt run for a yard. Baker Mayfield tries a deep pass, and then it's 3rd and 9, and you run left tackle with Kareem Hunt. I mean, that's just nonsense. There's 2 minutes left in the game. It's way too much time. you know, for the other team. You know, then the game at that point is, you know, they're down, what, 1 point? So, I mean, all they need is a field goal at that point. You have to be more aggressive if you're Cleveland in that spot. I think that's one of the worries I would have, you know, with Mayfield there. And they have some interesting decisions. You know, just to get away from the game for a second, I think if I'm Cleveland, and you're going to play this year out with who you've got. If I'm Cleveland next year, I'm going to be making calls. I would see if Russell Wilson's available. I'm not worried about Aaron Rodgers. Aaron Rodgers is too old. But I would see if Russell Wilson's available. If they want Baker Mayfield, and I'll take Russell Wilson. I'll assume Russell Wilson's going to give me at least 2 more years, and then I can probably extend him. I could probably get a 3, maybe 4 year window out of him. I'm going to have to extend Baker otherwise. And I would call for that. If things clear with Deshaun Watson, I would be calling Houston to see about that. I would look to see if they can find someone that values Baker Mayfield as a potential young quarterback, new face of a franchise kind of thing. And you can bring in someone's veteran who wants out or has fallen out of favor or whatever. I think I might do that if I was Cleveland next year, would be to look at that possibility. Now, maybe Mayfield will heat up. You know, Mayfield started terrible last year too, and then kind of heated up and got back to being a respectable player. But anyway, I thought he was a limiting factor. But then the cool thing, the other cool thing that happens is at the end of this game, so the Chargers are trying to not score, or at least they're trying to not score with a minute and a half left in the game. So what they're trying to do is basically, I'm assuming that what they were doing, I didn't hear any of the post game, but I'm assuming what they were doing, instead of kneeling the ball and playing for a field goal, I'm going to guess they wanted to make sure that the ball remained at like the somewhere between the 1 and the 3. So I think what they were looking to do was to run Eckler, try and gain a yard, you know, just have him tiptoe to try to gain a yard, go soft, and then go down. And then you get to second down and, you know, same kind of deal, you know, soft and go down, you know, they, you know, and then on third down, I guess you would try to get the touchdown, because by then you've burned as much time as you can burn. Now you try to get the touchdown, get the 2, and then you've got a great, great, great chance of winning. And you still got a pretty good chance, even though they scored, you know, but you wanted to just end the game right then and there. Now, if they were playing field goal, I have no idea why you're not just kneeling. If in your mind you're playing field goal, you should just be kneeling. You're so far down there, even though the kicking has been atrocious league-wide, you should be kneeling, because at least with the kneel, all you're doing is you're dealing with your exchange between the quarterback and the center. Now you got to deal with an exchange quarterback running back, and you've also got to deal with the fact that you're going to run him into the center of the line as a ginger runner, you know, like a real soft runner. Like you're playing, it would almost be the equivalent of playing to like not get injured or something like that. You know, it can only be something bad. But, you know, I mentioned on Twitter, like if I'm the Browns, like what would you do here? Like part of me says you just want to take him and carry him in, because I thought they were going to kneel it out. You know, you just find a way to grab him and just carry him in the end zone to make him score, because that's the only way you're going to get the football back. You know, I thought that was kind of there. Or, you know, the other thing is, you just keep your fingers crossed the guy misses a field goal. You know, it's a lot of pressure and maybe he misses it. He's been terrible for as much as that's a chip shot. You know, maybe he botches it. Maybe he misses. And by the time I sent that out, they basically did just that. They carried him into the end zone. And it was one of the smartest plays I think you could imagine. And they get the ball back, and they just the next drive is just awful. It's like they're sitting there with no time. You know, you have a minute and a half. You've got to drive the entire length of the field, and they are dinking and dunking. I'm just pulling it up here. 6 yard pass, 3 yard pass, 2 yard pass, 10 yard pass, spike the ball. Now you're just taking 3 deep shots. Down the sidelines, trying to get a touchdown. It's like at that point, you know, you've got 26 seconds left. You probably, given the way that kind of broke down, you probably want to try to get another pass there for another 10 or 15 yards to give you a better chance at your Hail Mary, because the Hail Mary play was kind of ugly. You had receivers running into each other. One guy looked like he ran out of the back of the end zone. They just didn't even give themselves an opportunity to, you know, to do that. And they were essentially just chucking the ball there for, you know, chucking the ball up. And, you know, it was a bad last two drives for Cleveland. But with that cool kind of, forcing them to score when they didn't want to, in between. And I thought that was really neat. Cleveland is an interesting team. Like I said, right now, I think their passing game is a clear limiting factor, but their running game is so dominant that they are one of those rare teams that I think could sit there and run the football and be very, very, very productive, because their running game is not, you know, 1 yard, 2 yard, 3 yard, 1 yard, 2 yard, 3 yard, 1 yard, 2 yard, 3 yard, 44 yards. That's not really their run game. Their run game can actually be very consistent there. And teams are not built in the NFL to deal with that. Teams are built in the NFL to stop passing offenses, you know, or at least attempt to. They're not built to kind of deal with some of these drives where, you know, you're just bludgeoning the other team to death. And they're certainly a team that if they go up early, I think they have that potential to just bludgeon you to death with the way they play offense. Their offensive line is terrific. You know, in that run game, that 1-2 punch is, I think, pretty unique. And, you know, that they are one of those teams where some of the running that they do, is really valuable. And when you can get some of that going, and you probably have more limitations, you know, out of your passing game, I think that those are the instances where you can look at the run and say, okay, you know what? This is an effective manner of playing. And, you know, maybe the Chargers don't even push it the way they pushed it if they didn't think that these guys had that kind of run capability as well, where they were just going to bleed clock while just trying to kind of pound you down, you know, with that. And I think the Chargers kind of took that out, you know, from them, and they try to make it more of a Baker Mayfield game, which is probably not the best of things for Cleveland right now. But the other thing that I think is interesting, and this is the last thing I'll talk about because now I'm over an hour. The last thing that I think I'll talk about with that is what you see from those two teams is, I think, what could be dangerous playoff teams. Cleveland's a lot better than I thought they would be. But what you saw are teams that are manufacturing points. Look, when you match up with teams like the Chiefs and the Bills, yeah, there is the argument any given Sunday, right? Any given Sunday, any team can win. But any given Sunday typically requires the other team to basically play their B game or C game and for you to play an A game. That doesn't happen very often. You know, what happens if Kansas City plays their A game? Most of the time, you don't have a chance. What happens if Buffalo plays their A game? You're probably not going to have a chance. But if you're doing stuff that's not traditional, you have a better understanding or a better grasp. You know, we talked about the fourth down stuff last week about, you know, if you're going to do it, be consistent, you know, consistent aggression and playing for four downs versus playing for three down drives. If you're going to do that kind of stuff, well, even though there's maybe a talent mismatch between your team and that team, and I know the Chargers already beat the Chiefs, but, you know, if you look at it like, okay, there might be a talent mismatch on paper. We're not getting lucky because these guys are, you know, these guys are zoned in. They're ready to go. They're doing it. You can make that up. You're going to make up that talent gap by playing these four down drives, this aggressive style of football to try to maximize your points out of situations where 31 or 30 other teams are not going to maximize their points. Look, if 30 other teams played against Cleveland, Cleveland wins that game going away. And if the Chargers played that game against anybody but Cleveland, I have a feeling they would have won that game with a field goal with no time left, or with a touchdown with basically no time left. So I think that's the cool thing about these two teams is I would look at them as dangerous because of the coaching staffs in the playoffs as much as I would about the talent on the field. I think they have that real potential to punch up without having to have like a super special game, while also at the same time the other team not having a perfect game. I think that what we saw are two teams that are able to kind of exploit the edges, I think, of what teams are kind of doing right now to be able to punch up in those games. Now, if things don't go your way on those, yeah, you're probably going to get blown out by even more than before. But what difference does it make? There's no style points in losing. You know, if the Chargers don't convert and they lose 42-20 or something like that, is there really any difference between, you know, losing 42-20 and losing 42-33? No, there's no difference. The only difference is what someone might be talking about on Monday where they're ripping decision-making or they're talking about how big of a margin it is. The grand scheme of things, it's the same loss. And one strategy gives you a chance to win. One strategy gives you a chance to lose not as bad. So for me, that was the biggest thing that I gained out of that game. I think is just that I can look at those two teams and say, you know what? There are things that they can do besides just having a quote unquote good coach and a good system and good players to push teams that might be better than them to where they can create the any given Sunday scenario, not have that any given Sunday have to fall to them. So I think that was, kind of my takeaway on that. But a fantastic game, just a really, really fun football game to sit there and watch. And I was glad I got the chance to, watch that one, because the other games were nothing like that. It was a very unique football game. Anyway, that's it for me this week. Hopefully I'll do a Spaces session this weekend, but I can't guarantee that. Troy should have a Spaces session this week on Tuesday. He does it Tuesday night. I'm asleep by then because I wake up for morning basketball usually on Wednesday. But Troy will have one, and I think he's going to start to put them online. So we'll get that up there on OTC once we figure the logistics out of that too. So everybody have a great week, and I will talk to you all again soon.